People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. This is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note, right here on Fine Music Radio. I have with me here in the studio, and I wish there were cameras and things, television-wise, I have the most magnificent book called Cape Town's Dockland by Brian Ingpen. And let me read you this. This most attractive, high-quality documentary takes readers from the wooden jetties of yesteryear to today's towering container gantries and the waterfront's allure. Through its evocative text and its over 750 carefully selected illustrations, you can almost smell the sea, you can taste the salt, you can see the cargoes, while on every page are images, stories, details and descriptions of ships from Union Castle's legendary mail ships, coasted and container ships, to tramp ships, tankers, tugs and trawlers. It is a nostalgia overload in many, many ways. But let me tell you about its author, Brian Ingpen, who has roamed Cape Town's docklands for nearly seven decades, boarding ships as a youngster, watching cargo work in the pre-container era, fascinated by the variety of ships that passed this way, riding on those old steam tugs and meeting people from across the world. And he watched the mail ships leave with their characteristic punctuality, surrounded by excitement and emotion. And Brian is with me here in the studio with this beautiful book. Brian, before we even start, I just have to say congratulations on a truly magnificent publication.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Rodney.
This is going to be a coffee table book par excellence, and I can't stop paging through it. I think the most obvious question to ask you, first of all, is why did you write it? Why did you publish it?
Well, I've been, as you've said, involved in the harbor one way or another over many years.
But many, many years, aren't they?
Yes, it's longer than I care to remember, I suppose, but it's been fun. It's been absolutely great fun. There have been moments of drama. There have been moments of memory. Everybody remembers Union Castle. And then there were the old cargo ships, the tramp ships that came in, the tankers and all the others. It's just been a wonderful experience for me, walking around the harbor, riding on the tugs, just getting involved. I spent a few years with Safarine as well, but it was my childhood memories that actually came to the fore. And I also had the privilege of walking around the harbor during the school Christmas holidays with George Young, who was the leading shipping journalist, certainly in Africa and probably among the best in the world, for school holidays. It was just great fun. And I was introduced to this world of shipping, and it's a lively world. It's a dynamic world. It's a world that is really interesting. Mm. And of course, in those days, you saw the cargoes. Now they're hidden in boxes. The cargoes are bales of wool or timber or whatever it was. And that was fun. The coasters coming in from Durban with their cargoes of sugar, their cargoes of rolled paper, the Lever Brothers products and so on. It was just a lively world that appealed to me as a youngster.
But why, how did it start? How did this attraction begin? Why were you attracted to the harbor? Can you remember a specific incident?
No, I can't really. My father was more interested in yachts. Not that he could afford a yacht. In fact, he could only afford just about to get to look at the yachts. But the other side of the harbor was where the ships were, and that's where I was focused. Mm-hmm. And then we rode on tugs. You know, it was a Sunday afternoon, Saturday afternoon excursion, school holidays, etc. And it was an era when one had contact with ships and contact with the people on board those ships. I walked on board ships as a kid, and they would say, okay, but don't go there, or just watch this or whatever, and never chased away.
Look how different it is. Now it's different. Completely out of bounds, isn't it?
Yes. As I say, Razorwire and Rottweilers now keep kids away, and there are good reasons for that, but sadly, in their planning for the security, they haven't allowed the public access to the ships or near the ships to see actual working harbor. Mm-hmm. The Cape Town passenger terminal is a case in point where one can have a reasonable view of ships, but it would be so much easier if, for example, Cape Town's breakwater were open to the public, where people used to fish, not just for leisure, but some of them actually for their food.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great pity that that's been closed. And you know, the security hawks will say it's for security reasons, but there's no way on earth it can be a security.
Well, that's what I was just going to ask you. How can that pier, the breakwater, how can that be a security risk? Unless someone's going to stand there and lob a bomb at a ship.
Well, then, you know, one asks why the various countries bring their warships into the waterfront. very much closer.
Yes.
And, you know, the waterfront has, to a large extent, kept the maritime atmosphere alive, and it's been a wonderful project, that, and mm-hmm. and full marks to those who dreamed of it and who put it into action and who are carrying on with it. But I do wonder why we are kept away from things when even electronic media would allow close-up viewing of containers being loaded, of all the other things that are happening in the harbor. You know, one remembers those big tankers that came in the 1950s for their survey dry docking. And they were then the largest ships in the world. They were not longer than the Queen Elizabeth, the passenger ship at the time, but they had a bigger dead weight, and so therefore were classed as the biggest ships in the world. Mm-hmm. And whole of Cape Town turned out to see them. It was just hundreds of people
sad.
Down there. To see these big tankers come in. And, of course, they're tiny tankers compared to what we have today. But, nevertheless, at the time, they were the largest ships in the world. And sadly, we've lost that. And I think Cape Town has also lost contact with the shipping world. And part of that is due to the demise of the point-to-point passenger services that we used to have. We don't have that anymore.
Mm.
You know, now if Granny's arriving, she comes to the airport and the kiddies go along and look at the planes.
Yes.
She doesn't come by sea, whereas my grandparents, when they came down from Durban to stay with us, they came on the Cape Town Castle. And there they were at the top of the gangway, my grandfather dressed in his hat and suit, my grandmother dressed as if she was going to the races. It was just simply an era that we had contact with, and we had contact with the ships because people traveled by sea in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's all aircraft.
All aircraft. And you've got, talking about Union Castle, I'm glad there's almost an emphasis on Union Castle in this book because they've been such an integral part, haven't they, of South Africa and England. But before we talk more about that, Brian, what is your first choice of music?
I'm one of these old-fashioned types, and I'm afraid for regular listeners to Fine Music Radio, I would be regarded as a bit of a philistine, I suppose. But I've gone for music of the 50s and 60s that I remember as a teenager, and one or two later ones as well. And one of the voices that appealed to me even as a young teenager was that of Jim Reeves with beautiful,
yes.
deep voice.
Yes, Kimberly
and,
Jim.
One could hear his words as well, which was fantastic. And the first one I've chosen is a nice romantic one called I Love You Because by Jim Reeves.
I love you because you understand, dear, every single thing I try to do. You're always there to lend a helping hand, dear. I love you most of all because you're you. No matter what the world may say about me, I know your love will always see me through. I love you for the way you never doubt me, but I love you because my heart is lighter every time I'm walking by your side. I love you because the future's brighter, the door to happiness you open wide. No matter what the world may say about me, I know your love will always see me through. I love you for 100,000 reasons, but most of all I love you 'cause you're you.
There we heard Jim Reeves, maybe a first on Fine Music Radio to hear that voice. I love you because, and it was the first choice of my guest indulging in nostalgia here, Brian Ingpen, well known as a columnist in the Cape Times. How long has your column been running on Ships and Shipping?
17 years, I think.
Oh, this, gosh, yeah. Okay. It seems longer somehow because you seem to have been around all the time. And I love the way you constantly call yourself Kortbroek. Kortbroeker.
Well, those were the days when khaki broek was the thing to wear, and yes, I was a short pants guy and riding around the harbour on a bicycle, and those are the memories that I have of a bicycle propped up against a crane, and then going to watch something happen, or going on board a ship. And the surprising thing is that one's bicycle was still there when I came back.
And you were allowed on ships in those days. I can remember my father in Durban taking me down to the mail ship, and you got a little ticket, and you could go on for a few hours and then be told when to get off. It was no problem.
Yeah, the mail ships, Union Castle operated their mail ships, and one of their things was to obviously cast the net wide for passengers to choose to sail in Union Castle ships. There were those visits to the mail ships, but also I used to just walk on board a ship in the harbour. And as I said, I was never chased away. Mm. One of the ships I went on board, and the British officer said, "What are you doing here, young man?" So I just come to look at the ship, and he said, "You better see the captain." That was the last thing I wanted to do. He took me up to the master, and then the master said, "Are you here to look at my ship?" So he said, "Yes." "Well, I'll give you a tour." So I got a guided tour by a four-ringed officer to show me around his ship. It was wonderful. And that was the reception generally that one got. I wouldn't say it was always cordial, but certainly it was never one get off the ship. Just a case of be careful here or be careful there. And that was a good attitude. Obviously, the times have changed, and there's more of the threat of stowaways and all that sort of thing.
Right.
And one understands that there are security measures in place. But as I've said earlier, it's important to keep parts of the harbour open for public viewing,
particularly
the breakwater,
yeah,
which is just a wonderful place. You get the best view of the mountain from there. It's just wonderful, and sadly, there's a big fence that keeps people out.
Oh, dear. Do you think that will ever change, Brian?
I don't know. You know, I would have thought that with all the legal minds around, we could have had a disclaimer board somewhere that would assist, but in winter, the swell does come over there, but, you know, as I always said, see more people get washed off Cork Bay Harbour jetty than off the breakwater. Okay. And I think that's something that can be addressed through a disclaimer notice. Mm-hmm. In the same way that the waterfront's got a disclaimer notice hidden away, nobody reads it, but there it is in case of an accident.
You also were lucky enough to get onto tugs. I remember also, may I just boast about my Durban days at the harbour, getting onto a tug was a major adventure for me, to take a ship out from its berth and out through the harbour mouth.
Yes, that was regular. And on some occasions, there were probably 30 or more people on board those tugs in the Sunday afternoon. And it was part of Cape Town's entertainment. And what it did was it introduced particularly young people to the harbor.
Mm.
And if you think back, you know, and my friends and I sometimes went down to the tug jetty during school holidays or weekends and sat there until the tug was about to move and then sort of looked pleadingly at the tug master. Yeah, come on board. And the thing is that he remembered probably that he had become interested in ships and shipping in the same way as we were now doing, on board tugs in harbors. You know, the well-known port captain of Cape Town, Captain Bill Damrell, he told me of many excursions on tugs in Port Elizabeth as a school kid. And that's what it's about. It's introducing young people to ships and shipping, and we thoroughly enjoyed it. And as a result, I mean, apart from anything else, our geography, our knowledge of world geography increased. You know, where's Panama? Where's this? Where's that? Look, we're importing this or we're exporting that.
That's very true. I'm not
and,
thinking
And
that.
So we developed an understanding of trade and understanding of shipping, and it was just great fun besides that. You know, just great fun.
Yeah, and you know, I've mentioned about the size of this book, the sheer sort of scale of it, of the things you cover, way back to 1859, right up to 2000 and beyond. And you've
don't remember too much about 1859, but
actually, that's interesting because I saw somewhere in your book you speak about something BC of the first people rounding the Cape.
Yes, there's the thought that the Phoenicians came round the Cape. Again, I don't remember that, but the idea is that they must have come round the Cape, although there's no formal written record of their voyage. And the first formal record of voyages via the Cape are those of the Portuguese navigators. There's also a thought that perhaps some Arab traders came this way or some Chinese traders, but no written record that I've been able to find. Maybe somebody has a record like that, but I haven't been able to find too much in that. But there may well have been people who came this way long before the Portuguese.
600 BC, you say. Yeah. The Portuguese, 1487. That's when sort of history picked up, didn't it?
That was the first recorded voyage.
Right. Okay, now we're going to have another one of your pieces of music. Another bit of nostalgia here, Pat Boone.
Yes.
Yes, tell me why you've chosen Remember Your Mine.
Yeah, again, you know, as a teenager, some of my friends were Elvis fans, and probably just to be different, I was a Pat Boone fan. We didn't have street fights over it, but nevertheless, there was, Pat Boone's number one this week, or Elvis's Jailhouse Rock is number one, or whatever. And this one I've chosen because I really like the backing, both the sort of choral backing and the musical backing. Remember Your Mine by Pat Boone.
Remember, remember your mine.
Be faithful, darling, while you're away. For when it's summer, a heart can stray. And though I'll miss you, have a wonderful time. But remember, darling, remember your mine. If you go dancing and he holds you tight, and lips are tempting on a summer night, your heart beats faster when the stars start to shine. Just remember, darling, remember your mind. I'll be lonely, I'll be blue, but I promise I'll be true. miss you. Have a wonderful time. But remember, darling, remember you're mine.
Remember you're mine.
As I said earlier, a bit of a nostalgia trip here, thanks to my guest, Brian Ingpen. Pat Boone, Remember Your Mine. And we're talking about Brian's latest book, a magnificent coffee table book called Cape Town's Dockland, filled with glorious pictures. Where did these pictures come from? Most of them I see are in your collection.
Yes. As I mentioned earlier, I was fortunate enough to travel the docks with George Young. And after his passing, there was this huge collection of photographs and negatives and all of ships that he had taken since 1929, because his own career with the Cape Times was 40-something years. So he had accumulated a massive collection of photographs and other bits and pieces of shipping interest. And after his passing, his son Rob kindly offered these to me. And it was quite a responsibility, because when I got home with this massive collection of negatives in envelopes, I suddenly realized what I'd got. And it was absolutely unique collection of photographic material, mainly of Cape Town Harbor. Probably 90-something percent of it is Cape Town, but there are others in Durban or even overseas. But it was a magical collection. It had recorded ships and shipping in Cape Town since 1929, and I think George probably stopped actively taking photographs around about 1990-ish, somewhere there.
Good gracious. What a long time.
So it was a long period of harbor photography. You know, in some cases, a mast had been chopped off or something, but it was the nostalgia associated with the photographs that appealed to me. Mm. And so I thought that rather than you just let them lie around, let other people see them as well. So with Rob's assistance in doing some editing of my text and so on, I put together the book and included these photos. Altogether, there are over 800 photographs in the book, some large, some small, some black and white, some color. And I think it portrays a history of Cape Town that many people will remember and be able to resonate with.
Was it difficult to try and sort out how to lay it out? I mean, your chapters are divided into years, but within those years you discuss, say, the Union Castles, the tugs, the warships, the trawlers, the container ships. Was that a difficult thing to work
yeah,
out?
The purists might say, well, you know, you got it wrong here, that belonged to that era or whatever, but I've told little stories. It's not a complete narrative. It's not a complete history of Cape Town Harbor. It's Cape Town Harbor, largely as I remember it, and also Cape Town Harbor stories that I came across in one way or another, mainly through George Young's writings. Of course, he wrote a daily column in the Cape Times for 40-something years, and the Cape Times appeared also on a Saturday in those days, so it was six editions a week. And he used to churn out a lot of very, very interesting material, and with it these photographs. And there are other photographs as well from good friends, and I've paid tribute to some of them, people like Peter Mellier, Robert Pabst, John Marsh, Ian Schiffman, and others. And, of course, my photographs, my son was a bit of a photographer, shipping photographer as well. So we've accumulated all these, and then kindly other people have allowed me to use their photos as well. So it's a collection. Probably most of them come from the George Young collection, but others are our family photographs, and also they come from other sources.
The quality of the book is very good. The paper you use, and I think, Brian, as you said before when we came into the studio, the paper has to be good in order to give credit to these photographs.
Yes, and what was nice is that it was printed locally. So it's an all South African production.
But will it be released internationally?
Yeah, it costs a bit of money to send it overseas. But
this is quite heavy, by the way.
It is.
It's not an easy thing to take on a plane or to give a gift.
It's not a pocketbook, no.
No, it's definitely a coffee table book. And also, among the many photographs you have, and among the text is a lot of your own reminiscences, isn't it? That's sort of very important as well, your own
thoughts. Yes, it is.
I
wanted it to be a personal recollection.
Yeah, that's the word I was looking for.
And, of course, the histories of some of the ships and the companies that were involved, and a little account here and there of what happened in the harbor, and the building of the container terminal, its extension a couple of years ago, not extension, its upgrade. And so we presented Cape Town's dockland as I knew it and as I know it today, and as I say, also stretching back a little bit further than my own memory to those times that also appealed to me. And fortunately, we've got some photographs or other illustrations to show that.
You know, one of the things that struck me, Ryan, is looking through this book, many of the ships look very dirty. You know, today you see the ships looking rather pristine, the white MSC liners, for example. But a lot of these ships, whether they are passenger ships or whether they are container ships, look rather dirty and run down.
I think in former years, of course, ships had coal-fired boilers.
Oh, there you go.
So they would be coaling, and, of course, the coal dust went everywhere. So that accounted for some of the apparent dirt on the side of the ships. But in recent years, also, there's a trend where the green lobby has caused bans to be enforced on painting overside on ships in harbor. That was where ships did a lot of maintenance of the hull.
Why would they ban that?
If paint went in the water.
Oh.
But it has meant that some ships actually look rather ropey today, and that's because the ships aren't allowed to paint overside, and therefore there are some rust streaks that otherwise would not have been there.
My
I know
goodness.
That Safran, for example, and other companies were very insistent that their ships looked really good when they came into port. And, of course, in Cape Town, the superintendents would swarm all over the vessel and see what was going on. And it was also a sense of pride on people on the ships. They really looked after the ships. And also, to be fair to today's seafarers, not only are the ships much bigger and therefore the painting of the hull becomes a huge task, but the crews are much smaller. You know, a Safran crew of yesteryear might have had 8 or 9 deckhands, maybe more, and today you might have 5, 6.
Mm.
So the crews are reduced, the time in port is also reduced.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the earlier ships that might have looked a little bit worse for wear may have come from a port where they were using lighters alongside to discharge the cargo, and therefore the lighters might scrape the vessel, etc. So, but I think most ships, officers and crews would take pride in their ship.
Oh, yes, and some of them look beautiful,
good.
As we know,
yeah.
Especially the passenger liners.
Yes, yes.
Now your next piece of music, Mr. Brian Ingpen, my guest on People of Note this week, Nina and Frederick.
Oh, yes, this is a nice little song. It's just got a nice lilt to it. There's a line in it that goes something about little white birds clinging to the crest of a wave rolling by. There's a beautiful image there, and that's always stuck with me. Nina and Frederick, Listen to the Ocean.
There's a world of sun and sand, full of sky and far from land, where evening breezes caress the shore like a gentle comforting hand. Fragrant blossoms, honeybees, careless laughter upon the breeze, a lover's feet into pools of deep purple shadows among the trees.
Listen to the ocean, echoes of a million seashells, forever it's in motion, moving to a rhythmic and unwritten music that's played eternally.
Listen to the ocean. distant cry. His wings like parentheses drawn in the sky, and two white birds clinging like foam to the crest of a wave rolling by. The silence of noon, the clamor of night, the heat of the day when the fish won't bite. These are the things that remind me of the day you sailed out of sight.
Listen to the ocean, echoes of a million seashells. Forever it's in motion, moving to a rhythmic and unwritten music that's played eternally.
Touch of the Sea for you. Listen to the Ocean, Nina and Frederick, and another choice of my guest on People of Note here on Fine Music Radio this week, Brian Ingpen, the writer in the Cape Times every week of a shipping column, and also has released a number of books, including his latest one. I'm almost tempted to call it your magnum opus, except that I haven't seen your other books, Brian, because it's really so magnificent. Tell me a little bit about you. I mean, I asked you at the beginning how you became interested in the harbor and ships, but I know you were a teacher for a while at Weinberg, or maybe a long while, and you've always been interested in the youth.
Yes, I started a teaching career. My first post was Weinberg Boys High School in 1974 as very much a raw teacher, and I ended at the Law Hill Maritime Center in Simonstown, and that was after 46 years in education. 23 of which were at the Law Hill Center. But it varied. I tried to teach geography to young people, and hopefully one or two of them learned a few things.
I have a friend who you taught, by the way, at Weinberg, who speaks very highly of you.
Oh, dear.
There you go.
Well, anyway, it's been fun. I was principal of two schools during that time, Simonstown School and also Pinelands High. And but the last 23 years have been an interesting pioneering voyage in that we put together the Law Hill Maritime Center attached to Simonstown School, and it's been fun.
What is that? Explain that, what that is, Brian.
Yeah, for grades 10, 11, and 12, young people from all over the country can follow a maritime course where they do the usual subjects, two languages, maths, and science. And then they have the opportunity of doing three maritime-related subjects. One is called maritime economics, which is the shore side of shipping and the economics, etc., involved, trade patterns and all that. And then there's another one called nautical science, and that's to do with navigation, seamanship, ship stability, cargo stowage, and those sort of aspects. And that's largely to prepare young people who may want to go to sea as their careers. And the third subject is called marine sciences, which is a combination of oceanography and marine biology. And those three subjects then give young people the opportunity to choose a variety of careers. And some go into all sorts of interesting maritime-related careers, and others go into careers that aren't related to the maritime industry directly. Some have become medics. Some have gone to work in banks or in commerce. So it's just a nice springboard, shall we say, that young people can use to enter the maritime industry in one way or another, be it at sea or ashore or in the research aspects that are now growing in importance in making sure that the sea stays clean.
Indeed. And what has the response been? Have there always been people going to these schools?
Oh, yes. At Law Hill, we would turn away a number of young people, unfortunately.
Oh.
There's a boarding facility that can take 67 boarders, and then there's some day students as well.
Mm-hmm.
So We've had youngsters from all over the show. Some haven't seen the sea before. Some have come from rural areas and become master mariners. There are some that are in command of ships these days.
Gosh,
and
it.
Others have gone into the shipping industry ashore.
And are you still involved with this, Brian?
No. I retired at the end of 2019. And there's an energetic team there, and they're taking it on. Yeah.
And talking about retiring, and you've done this book now, which I see is right up to date, right into the whole COVID thing here. Do you still wander around the harbor, maybe not in Kortbroek?
No, not in Kortbroek. I also find it a bit restrictive, but I take a great interest in what's happening, particularly to keep up to date so that I can write reasonably intelligently for the Cape Times each week. Yes.
Okay. But it must be a challenge that you continue to enjoy because so much has changed. I mean, one of the things I was going to mention about the many changes was the container innovation, really. Didn't that change shipping dramatically, both in the look of ships and in just the whole way the harbor dealt with them?
Absolutely. I mean, a whole new part of the harbor had to be constructed.
Mm-hmm.
New ships had to be constructed. Custom-built ships to take the containers had to be constructed. And it was a worldwide thing. I mean, our trade was containerized in 1977, whereas, for example, the Europe-Australia trade had been containerized in the mid-1960s.
Mm.
So ours was a bit of a Johnny-come-lately, but that helped because we could learn from the mistakes of others.
Mm-hmm.
So when our ships came on the service, our container ships came on service, we'd learned a few tricks from others, and I think we did it a bit more smoothly than others. Cost a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Ships, of course, now are floating box boats, as they're nicknamed, and they don't have the elegant lines of some of the older freighters. But remember that one of those, at the time, we're talking of one of those ships that came in could carry about 60,000 tons of cargo. And that took the place of perhaps five or six of the conventional freighters that had plied the trade before.
Wow.
They were automated to a large extent as well. So it meant crews were smaller, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a radical change. We also saw, and this was a sad thing that I think is highlighted in the book, we saw a lot of shipping companies disappear into these huge consortia that put together the container companies, container ship companies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there weren't the Shaw Savills anymore. Even the Union Castle disappeared. And so a handful of companies were left running the containerized services.
What happened?
It was a huge change.
What happened to the Ro-Ro ships? Or are they still in existence?
The South Africa, on the South African trade, there were four big Ro-Ro ships, two French and two Swedish.
Mm.
And they brought not only containers, but they also brought a lot of unusual cargo, project cargo. And
which they could literally roll off.
Cargo which they could literally roll on and roll off the ship.
Yeah, yeah.
And on big sort of trailer things with umpteen wheels. And at the time, and we're talking in the 1970s and 80s, you know, South Africa was building all sorts of things from power stations to Sasol plants and all that. And a lot of that equipment came out on those Ro-Ro ships.
Okay.
They were fantastic ships, really high-tech, sophisticated vessels. All four of them disappeared from our trade during the sanctions era. We went from nine conventional container ships and four Ro-Ro ships down to four ships on the South African trade during the sanctions era.
Gosh.
So there was a huge bite into the trade, and that reflected in the number of ships that were operating.
Let's have another piece of music, Brian.
Can we go for Petula Clark and
yes.
Sailor?
Right, another note, yes.
Probably very pertinent to the subject of our conversation.
Absolutely.
And so Petula Clark with Sailor.
Sailors, stop your roaming. Sailor, leave the sea.
you sail across the sea, all my love is there beside you. In Capri or Amsterdam, Honolulu or Siam, to the harbor of my heart I will send my love to guide you as I call across the sea.
Petula Clark, and that piece was called Sailor, and another choice of my guests, a very nautical people of note today, because we're talking to Brian Ingpen, shipping correspondent for the Cape Times, winner of the Order of Baobab Silver. That's just happened, hasn't it, Brian? Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you. Yes, that was awarded towards the end of November. Unfortunately, I was in Canada doing research on another book, and my son went up to receive it on my behalf, and I was very obviously humbled by it.
Yes,
but it also reflected sort of a team effort, really, for the work at Law Hill. A very dedicated team put Law Hill together over the years. And also there were sponsors and other supporters who played a huge role in getting Law Hill on its feet and then keeping it going and encouraging both the staff and the young people and employing some of those young people. So it's been a team effort of individuals, several individuals, and a number of very good supporters and sponsors who've been very, very loyal and very understanding and very supportive and encouraging over the years.
This Law Hill thing is clearly something very close to your heart and has been now for all these years, hasn't it? And clearly continues to be.
Yes, I think it's one of those things that one looks back on and says, well, it was fun doing it, you know.
Right, and you've been awarded. Yeah. Just in the last few minutes we have of our interview, Brian, as always, time is against you in radio. What was lovely about this book, apart from the beautiful production, as I've been raving about, is the old names, Elliman and Bucknell, the city of Exeter, the city of Durban, and, as you said, Shaw Saville, the Southern Cross, the Northern Star, those ships that we got to know so well passing through our harbors here. So pictures tell a story, don't they, of these beautiful liners?
Yes, they had beautiful lines, those ships. You know, modern cruise ships really look like floating blocks of flats.
They do.
And so these elegant liners of yesteryear, they played a different role and therefore obviously looked different because most of them carried cargo as well. The Shaw Saville, the two Shaw Saville ships didn't. But Union Castle actually made their money out of cargo, not passengers.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, the ships looked really lovely lines and so on. The Element ships, always beautiful, immaculately maintained. The Holland Africa vessels, the Portuguese ships and so on that came here. So we had quite an array of passenger ships passing through. And, you know, many of us remember a trip along the coast or something on the whatever castle or
yes,
the city of something. And those are the memories that we hang on to. And I think I'm one of the fortunate generation that was able to do that. My father was a church employee who earned very little, but somehow he managed to save up for us to travel near the propeller on Arundel Castle or something to East London a couple of times. And those are the memories that stick.
And you've got them here written down for all of us, or in perpetuity, as we say. You've even got the RMS St. Helena, and my favorite ship of all, the QE2, because we talk about the shape of ships. I mean, the Queen Mary 2 is nowhere near as beautiful as the QE2.
Queen Mary's starting to get into people's hearts as well.
Is it okay?
she's not the traditional block of flats. She still looks something like a ship. But you mentioned the St. Helena. I mean, that was a fantastic voyage to St. Helena Island, with 5 days at sea, a few days on the island, then 5 days back again. And I always wonder whether it was right that the island should do away with that ship, because the voyage on the ship was most of the holiday.
Absolutely, completely. We did an FMR. We did two FMR cruises on there, and the ship part was definitely a major part of the holiday.
Yes, but one had the island spirit immediately one boarded, because most of the crew were islanders. And eventually the master, chief engineer, everybody from top to bottom were from the island. So one got a very nice introduction to the island and to the island spirit and those lovely people from St. Helena.
Yeah, and the saints.
Yeah, and, you know, the island doesn't have any beaches, et cetera, like Mauritius might have, or Seychelles. And so if one's been to St. Helena by air now, well, you go there, you enjoy it, and you leave again. But you may not go back, whereas the voyage on the ship was the enticement for many people to go back, just to enjoy those few days at sea in really a lovely, lovely voyage, lovely cuisine, and a fantastic atmosphere on board.
Ryan, we're going to have to stop. We could go on for another hour, but I'm afraid we have to stop talking about ships and shipping in the harbor. And thank you so much for being so gracious with your information that we've been sharing, and for this beautiful book. It's called Cape Town's Docklands, and a really magnificent coffee table book. So, Brian, thank you. And as I say goodbye, what is your last piece of music?
It's The Prayer by Charlotte Church and Josh Grogan. It's part of my own faith as well, and so I want to share this with the listeners, The Prayer.
Brian Ingpen, thank you very much.
sogniamo il mondo senza più violenza, un mondo di giustizia e di speranza.
Thank you.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.